the continued squeeze, as you've been saying, for the past 40 years on the working class and the middle class, it seems that in many countries around the world, that's leading more and more toward fascist movements and right-wing movements than it is to strong left-wing or socialist movements. I'm wondering your sense of what the future holds.
Well, I think what we're seeing in my own sense of, and I follow it quite closely.
And we have about a minute and a half left, yeah.
Particularly in Europe, is that you're seeing the fruits of the last 75 years. We've lived in a country that has been beset by the Cold War, that is lost in this notion of a great struggle between capitalism and socialism, in which you can't allow anything on the left to get very far without repression by the government or without unfair treatment in the media. So I'm not so surprised that as the situation unravels, the first instinct of people is to be responsive to the right, which has been able to function in the Western world much more freely than the left has. But I don't find that at all surprising. Mm-hmm. I think when the people of this country realize how few solutions the right wing has. Look at what Mr. Trump didn't achieve in all the things he promised. Then you'll see an appreciation that maybe we ought to try the left. The crucial question is whether the left will be courageous enough to say what's going on and to offer a real alternative.
Well, Richard Wolff, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Professor Emeritus of Economics at University of Massachusetts, now visiting professor at the New School here in New York, founder of Democracy at Work, host of Economic Update, author of a number of books, including The Sickness in the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. The time is 8 a.m. Next up is a Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
Good morning. Excuse me. I was just singing along with the music there. This is Paul Roland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO. I turned down my headphones. Okay. Yeah, feeling hot, hot, hot. I guess that's a kind of an obvious opening song there, isn't it? Yeah, but it is. Are you feeling it? How are y'all doing? I imagine most of you are dealing with this. You know, and carrying on. I'm sure some of you are struggling, and my heart goes out to you. I hope you're doing what you can, asking for help if you need it. There are cooling centers out there open. I don't actually have that information, but it is widely available. If anyone wants to find that out, you can give us a call and I will look that up for you. I can't imagine living out on the streets in weather like this. I see some people have double kind of canopies. They've got a tent and then some shade over it. I imagine that is quite a bit better. But 100 degrees outside, no fun at all. So I hope everybody's surviving this. We are about halfway through, folks, if you are here in the Northwest, about halfway through. So we can just make it through to Saturday. It's going to cool down just into the 90s. So yeah, we are going to be talking about that. Richard Wolff was just talking about the economy spinning out of control. We are going to be talking about the climate spinning out of control. He was talking about whether, right there at the end, whether the left will be courageous enough to say what's really going on. We here at KBOO are courageous enough to say what's really going on about a lot of things. And as I said, we will be talking about the climate. There are other things to talk about if you want to. The number, I'm here by myself, the number to call in will be and is 503-231-8187. I'm going to be reading from a few articles about some heat records that have been smashed right, left, up and down, and all around. It's scary, let's just face it. It's not a pleasant prospect we're facing. I don't know. Sometimes I wonder what my role here is as a talk show host. I know it's to inform. I guess to some extent it's to entertain, I guess. Sometimes it seems like it's to scare the bejesus out of people, and hopefully some of the people who are listening will be, you know, a little further prodded, shocked, disturbed into taking whatever actions there are that are available to us. They seem to be closing down one by one as we fail to act in a decisive way. By we, I guess I mean, you know, the nation states and the corporations. Those are the big powers that have us by the short hairs. They're the ones who claim to be serving and protecting us. I was going to say, you know who that slogan is. But yeah, I mean, that's the raison d'être, the reason for being of the nation state, supposedly, is to defend its inhabitants. It kind of, people band together to form a pact to protect from whatever forces, from hostile outside forces, from, you know, originally, I guess it was dangerous wild animals, the perimeter set up. Then, you know, with interhuman conflict, it became a conflict between different tribes, different societies, different nations. And the reason for the corporations, supposedly they're here to supply us with what we need. Of course, as Richard Wolff was just saying, with a sick system like this, it's flaws in its ability to actually deliver the goods are being revealed for all to see. And the manufactured consent is still so strong regarding the necessity of markets to solve our problems. The magical myth of the myth of the magical markets. Anyway, I could editorialize, but I want to go, as I said, to talk about, first of all, if it's not obvious, I mean, I belong to some Facebook groups that are sort of, there's one called Climate Change Battle Royale. I forget what it used to be called. They just kind of put it right out there a year or two ago with that name. because people just kind of slug it out, and there's, you know, the usual suspects of climate deniers on there basically, you know, throwing smoke at every opportunity and saying, oh no, you know, look at all the cold, you know, there's a big cold snap. How could there be global warming? Well, I mean, as if we need further evidence, heat records are far outpacing cold records across the globe so far this year. This is from July 18th. According to the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, around the world, 188 all-time heat records have been broken so far. I'm sure that's gone way up, compared with just 18 cold records. Climate scientist at Princeton University says the record imbalance is a sign of climate change. Duh. Okay, well, there's that article. And, yeah, so hundreds of temperature records fell over the past week in the United States as an intense heat wave continues to blast the U.S. And, of course, we are in the middle of one of them, is it better or worse than last year? I mean, 116 degrees, folks, that was scary hot. Just walking outside the house, that blast furnace of heat. Boy, it frightened me. So, yeah, I can stay outside. You know, I am, you know, lucky, blessed, privileged to live in a house that, A, has a couple excellent shade trees and is well insulated, so it tends to keep, you know, fairly cool as a rule, not when it gets into these kind of temperatures. But I did have a couple of emergency air conditioners stashed away, which I have pressed into service, mainly because of my old mom, but not just. I tend to get a little foggy brained when I'm in a house that gets too warm for too long. Anyway, so compared to last year, I guess I was, before I go off on some of these statistics here, it's the duration of this one is quite a bit longer, which makes a big difference. The effects of these things are really, you know, they're just starting to study the effects of these really extreme heat waves like last year, because these are unprecedented events. There's really no, you know, there's no data sets, and there's no record, you know, of ecological social effects for these things. We're sort of studying as we go along. But yeah, when you blast, you know, an ecosystem that's not used to getting 5 or 6 consecutive days hovering around 100 degrees, it's unknown territory we're in. Okay, so the big picture, this is from Axios from just a few days ago, July 24th. The deadly heat wave set or tied 359 daily high temperature records over the last week, along with 709 records for the warmest overnight low temperature. And we're used to get, you know, when it's hot here in the summer, we're used to getting, you know, still in the 60s, maybe even 50s at night. Now we're lucky to get to 70. They got just below 70, which is a blessing compared to some places where it doesn't even get below 80, let alone 90. That's what was so bad about that 116 degree, that in the, well, it was 106 or whatever in the 116. Anyway, so officials report at least 2 heat-related deaths in the Northeast on Sunday, and warned that likely to be more. 90 million Americans were under heat warnings and advisories on Sundays. In the past 30 days, this is as of 4 days ago or so, 1,403 daily high temperature records and 2,856 records for warmest overnight low temperatures have been set or tied. The National Weather Service notes that new records are set or tied in several cities on Sunday, including Boston, Massachusetts, which reached 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and Providence, Rhode Island, which hit 96 degrees, you know, Providence being right there on the ocean, so that is highly unusual. Newark's temperature reached 100 degrees on Sunday afternoon, not only a new daily record high, but now the 5th consecutive day as such temperatures in the New Jersey City. Can you imagine being in Newark with 100 degrees for a few days in a row? Yeah, this is the longest streak since records began, the NWS said. Again, that's what we're having. We're having, you know, not just, you know, a day or two. are having these lingering times, which are just so hard on us all. What to watch: widespread low temperature records were forecast to be broken across the mid-Atlantic and Northeast overnight, as lows struggle to drop below the upper 70s and low 80s. And it goes on, and it says, well, be smart. Heat waves become particularly dangerous when overnight temperatures fail to cool down enough to provide people with relief from the heat, increasing the odds of heat-related illness. And so that's that from Axios. It's going on all over the globe, folks. And this is from, what's the date on this? Anyway, this is from Forbes of a few days ago. Week of heat, these major temperature records were shattered in scorching heat waves. Record books across the world had to be rewritten this week. July 23, so again, this is almost a week ago now, had to be rewritten this week as a series of intense heat waves gripped large sections of the Northern Hemisphere, headlined by a scorching European heat wave that in some cases shattered records by several degrees. Here are the most shocking temperature readings. Coringsby in eastern England rose to 104.5 degrees Fahrenheit, obliterating the previous all-time record high in the United Kingdom of 101.7. That's almost three full degrees above, recorded in 2019, so just recently. Scotland and Wales also set their own all-time records during the early week heat wave, with Hawarden, Wales hitting 98.8 degrees, et cetera, et cetera. I could go on and on. But, you know, I don't know if you all have been to the UK in the summer, but it can be downright chilly in the summer there. I've experienced it. And so they're just not used to this. Temperatures also rocketed across much of Western continental Europe. Hamburg in Northern Germany set an all-time record high of 104 degrees. Well, Abed, Denmark hit 96.6, hottest ever recorded in the country during July. A separate heat wave in East Asia sent the mercury soaring there. In Taiwan, it hit 106 degrees Fahrenheit Friday, setting a new record for the hottest temperature ever recorded on the island. And I could go on and on and on. It's, as I said, it's scary. Scary stuff happening. And still, we wage wars instead of redirecting our bloated military budgets across the world and our military personnel themselves to, you know, turning swords into plowshares, swords into, you know, military hardware and budgets into alternative energy systems, into low tech cooling solutions that there are, you know, swamp cooler type stuff as opposed to air conditioners, you know, which are necessary for a lot of people, unfortunately, but contribute to the problem. So, while we contemplate the heat wave here, there's even more disturbing things, that like what's happening to the Greenland ice sheet. Greenland was hit with unusually extensive melting of their ice sheet, boosting sea levels discernibly. This is from phys, phys.org, physics.org, from July 25th. It's getting hotter in Greenland, and last weekend temperatures rose enough to cause 18 billion tons. I mean, who would even think that there are 18 billion tons? There must be trillions of tons. Trillions and trillions, and they're going fast. 18 billion tons of the country's ice sheet to melt over a three-day period. Scientists have warned about the impending fate of Greenland's ice sheet and say what happened between July 15 and 17 is the latest massive melting event, contributing to an increase in the global sea level. The amount of water from the July 15 to 17 melt, about 6 billion tons per day or 18 billion tons over the weekend, is enough to, quote, cover West Virginia in a foot of water, 4 inches per day, roughly. said a senior research scientist at the University of Colorado's Earth Science and Observation Center. Much of the melting came from northern Greenland because warm air drifted over from the Canadian Arctic archipelago. There's also a high-pressure dome over Greenland. Together, they created an unusually extensive melt event. So that's that. And I think that might be connected to a massive northern Pacific. No, it's the Atlantic. I'm not sure. It's probably, who knows? It's all related because it's a total destabilization of the global climate system. But the northern Pacific is suffering a massive heat wave that's increasing water temperatures by just astounding amounts. I don't actually have that article up here, but you know, up to like 10 degrees or something. Anyway, there's probably going to be a massive marine die-off. So yeah, we're in the midst of it. I've over the years talked about things spinning out of control, that things are happening much, much faster than even, you know, the best computer models have been able to demonstrate, more than the IPCC reports, the International Panel on Climate Change of the UN have said. But of course, early this year, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in its report, issued their own very dire warnings. Reacting to the latest findings of the IPCC, the UN Secretary General insisted that unless governments everywhere reassess their energy policies, the world would be uninhabitable. His comments reflected the IPCC's insistence that all countries must reduce their fossil fuel use substantially, extend access to electricity, improve energy efficiency, increase the use of alternative fuels such as hydrogen. Unless action is taken soon, some major cities will be underwater, et cetera, et cetera. The UN chief added, this is not fiction or exaggeration. It is what science tells us will result from our current energy policies. And anyway, providing the scientific proof to back up that damning assessment, the IPCC report, written by hundreds of leading scientists and agreed by 195 countries, noted that greenhouse gas emissions generated by human activity have increased since 2010 across all major sectors globally. Anyway, I could go on with that. As I keep insisting on, we really have to, I think, reorient our efforts to demand a global demilitarization. It is the militarization that drove this whole process from the very beginning. That, you know, the origins of standing armies, the origins of centralized control systems that led to the capitalist economic system and industrial capitalism and the massive use of fossil fuels, all driven by militarism. So militarism has to be the number one on our number one focus. And Nancy Pelosi cannot go to Taiwan. This is no time to be playing geopolitical games. We have to put on the table with China, with Russia, serious, serious diplomatic initiatives to agree to this global reduction in production of armaments, military uses of fossil fuels in the military, et cetera, et cetera. No more war, fight climate change. And I'm going to be talking a lot about that over the coming weeks and months. Okay, so I wanted to read particularly one article from Counterpunch, and I do want to acknowledge a series of articles that are running on my friend Patrick Maz's blog post called The Raven, and it's about a book called let me just look up Counterpunch because it's on the same as this article I was looking for. Oh, goodness. I'm just getting messed up. Okay, I'm going to read from this article, and then I'll look up this article by Patrick Maza, basically talking about the history of the history of militaries and the development of the kind of economic system that we have, I'm not doing it justice, but I will talk about that a little bit further on towards the end. Again, 503-231-8187. Okay, this is Wobbling Towards Our Own Extinction by Darian Rezazad in Counterpunch, yesterday's Counterpunch. As most regular Counterpunch readers know, Robert Hunsaker, who I've had a couple times on this program, but not for a few years, has over the past years provided excellent analysis on the latest climate catastrophe news. On March 24th, I sent him an email regarding what I'm calling the Great Wobble Problem, which I was hoping he would dismiss and reassure me that I was just indulging in doom and gloom. Below is our email exchange. Hi, Robert. I am a regular reader of your Counterpunch articles and always find them to be very well presented and informative. Back in the early 70s, when in high school, the problem of the, quote, hothouse effect entered my awareness. In college, my mentor, Professor Oliver Loud, was on the first draft of his unpublished book, Challenge of the Human Future, where he argued that we had five generations to solve the world's great problems, otherwise would sink back to how things were 1,000 years ago, and would not be able to rise up again due to the damage we had caused to the environment. He was in his 70s and included his generation in the five. I might take issue in that particular historical assessment, but I'll leave that for now. For the past 6 years, I've kept a Facebook page which has become a databank of the most important articles focused on the environment. Pivotal Clean Tech of Iran. Oh, he's from Iran. Okay. After reading all these articles, almost 500 of them, it is hard not to be pessimistic. The reason I'm writing you is because I've yet to come across any articles that specifically address the issue of things spinning out of control. Most projections and models have a linear outlook, assuming that the temperature will steadily rise and storms, fires, etc., will get worse and worse, and sometime around 2100, it will be 3 degrees hotter and sea levels will be higher. But I have my doubts that things will happen in this way. Like a spinning top, things will approach a point where the top will start to wobble and go into a chaotic, unpredictable, drunken trajectory and suddenly collapse on its side. When the jet stream changes direction and all the other tipping points enter the red zone, most likely it will become impossible to grow food like before because the seasons will quickly go out of whack. And when you can't grow food except under artificial conditions, then civilizational collapse is a certainty. Just look at how Ukraine's supply of sunflowers and wheat is causing problems around the world. The reason I bring this up is because our so-called leaders are operating from the assumption that the top will continue to spin, but gradually will spin slower and in a predictable pattern. But I think we are starting to see the first wobbles of the top, and each wobble will be worse than the previous one. The massive, quote, abnormal temperatures at the North and South Pole are actually a normal wobble. I assume this issue has been studied and written about, but somehow it does not seem to have entered the mainstream, or at least I've missed it. Just thought I'd bring it up, and also thank you for your great reporting. I've reached the conclusion that things will only change when saving the planet is very profitable, but maybe that's what we need to work on, rather than sound the alarm and assume leaders will see the light and change course. Happy Iranian New Year, Darian Rezazad. And again, this is a letter to Robert Hunsaker, a longtime climate journalist who writes for Counterpunch and a number of others, and again, who I've had on a couple times, but not for a few years. So this is Robert writing back. Hi, Darian. Thanks for writing. And quite frankly, I found your email message more interesting and indeed more profoundly accurate than any I've received in years. So congratulations for that. You have an impressive grasp of the situation and understanding of the levers of mitigation or lack of it. And yes, you are correct. There is nothing published in the public domain that approaches your suggestion of the reality of the climate change imbroglio and of how soon it could evolve into universal pandemonium. And in part, that's why it will occur, unannounced and with a viciousness that upends many traditional aspects of normal life behavior and patterns. I will add that there are people kind of at the, what people might think, the extreme end of the scientific community who actually have been writing about this, and I'm sure Robert knows that, but not published in these official peer-reviewed journals. Okay, I'll continue with Robert Hunsaker's response. And of course, that's precisely what happened in 79 AD to the Roman city of Pompeii when Mount Vesuvius blew its top. The residents of Pompeii knew about the eruption, but assumed it would blow over in time and thus carried on with their daily chores, which is precisely why today we can visit Pompeii, which I have done, and see perfectly preserved forms of Romans encased in volcanic ash. It's an eye-opening experience to see. So yes, as you seem to accept, we'll be blindsided, probably within a decade or two, by sudden loss of crops, amongst other horrors, which is, by the way, what causes the mass exodus from Central American countries that have suffered extreme drought conditions. They pack up and head out for North America, still somehow believing in the, quote, land of opportunity aphorism of yesteryear. This is a fairly long response to your email, and I'll close by informing you that I do have an article coming out tomorrow that delves into exactly what you are concerned about. The title is The Truth About IPCC Reports. Coincident with your timely email today, my article tomorrow addresses some of the same issues. I guess this proves that great minds think alike. At least I like to think that is true. Okay, so then he continues. Again, this Iranian, Darian Razazad, who wrote an email to Robert Hunsaker, and now he continues. So if the great wobble problem is likely or even worse, the first wobble is in progress. We must direct all our resources toward correcting this first and most critical wobble. How to go about this is the issue, because currently the assumption is that scientific evidence, reasoning, and common sense will prevail, and the denier, skeptics, and climate catastrophe criminals will come around, and the problem will be solved. This is wishful thinking and has a very low chance of success, because human greed, stupidity, political tribalism, and system-wide built-in environmental destruction is pushing us over the cliff. The fossil fuel industry has been making $3 billion profit every day for the past 50 years. Instead of pulling our hair out and ranting about how this has been a disaster for the planet, we need to focus on how to quickly create a system where reversing climate catastrophe can be even more profitable, especially for corporations like the fossil fuel industry. Instead of attempting to cure human beings of greed, we need to use greed to save the planet. We need to use greed to clear away the microplastics that are now in our air, water, and body. Instead of writing laws and regulations with the assumption that enlightened individuals and corporations will comply and we will end up saving the planet, we need to instead lead them to the trough and indirectly save the planet. We need to make greed-driven people like Trump turn green and have... Anyway, he goes on, I disagree. I disagree that I think that the profit model is inherently incapable of addressing this problem. And I don't have it enough worked out in my head to be able to off the cuff give you why I feel that's true. As I said, I think struggle, the people's struggles are still the most likely thing. And I think we need to, with the existing people's struggles, and I actually went to an interesting event this past Sunday with a number of Filipino-American and allies and supporters, accomplices, event to reject the new Marcos regime. Yes, a son of Ferdinand Marcos, Ferdinand Jr., was elected to the presidency of the Philippines. Anyway, it was a very lively event. I find the Philippine activist community to be one of the most radical and active in Portland. And if you're looking for anything to support, I think that is a potentially good one. Especially now, as I said, I think it's increasingly important with these global conflicts, with the global conflict with China. Philippines is in a very critical place. It's always had a very close but fraught relationship with the United States. It's definitely a victim of United States colonialism around the time that the United States, with the Spanish-American War, got seized Puerto Rico. It also seized the Philippines. And anyway, long history. Brutal, brutal colonial war happened there. And so, yes. I ran into an old pal of mine, comrade of mine, who's belongs to the International League of People's Struggles, which I actually had known about. I'll have him on my show. And I told him this idea of the militarism being the principal contradiction to addressing climate change, because A, the military started this whole ball rolling, fueled expansionism, fueled colonialism and imperialism, led to the existing world system, all fueled the kind of technological innovations that led to all the machinery, industrial machinery, which use fossil fuels, led to the whole financial capitalist system, which finances this whole system, the whole system of industrial production, consumption, distribution, et cetera, and is continuing to finance the fossil fuel industry, despite pleas like our friend here who wrote this article. And so that's A, it caused this system. B, it is the biggest user of fossil fuels, the biggest contributor to greenhouse gases, the world's militaries. The U.S. military is the single biggest institutional consumer of fossil fuels. So that's B, it continues to contribute directly to the problem. And C, global conflicts and tensions exacerbated by military production and sales of military, the destabilizing effect of arms sales around the world, and the conflicts that are created and exacerbated by military, all prevent the focusing of attention on this massive threat, global threat. Not to mention the fact that militaries tend to support unequal social and economic systems and social misery. So there you have it. So he basically agreed, and we're going to be talking about that. And he was at a in Spain at a anti-NATO summit recently. So hopefully we'll be hearing from him in the next few weeks. And very interesting, you know, because, you know, we also agreed how dismal this whole war in Ukraine situation is, where people who before the war basically would have, their principles, their analysis, their politics would have led them to being against a, well, we're all, presumably all of us listening are against war in general. But the idea that this war was somehow just Putin's making was somehow like inevitable, and that we're the good guys supporting Ukraine is a myth, is the kind of myth, and I've had several guests on to talk about this, which have led to the United States being embroiled in our own wars and used our own subterfuge to get into these wars. No, it was a preventable war. We could have, the United States, we, our government, could have done very concrete steps to avoid this war. Maybe made some unpleasant compromises, but this is a time when you need to make global, bilateral and multilateral agreements, understandings, treaties, conventions, protocols to deal with the real problems facing the world and not let ourselves get into these kind of wars like happened with other wars in the past. Okay, so anyway, so yes, yeah, so these people who should know better, and some of you who are listening might be some of those people, and I'm not going to hold back. You need to look again. It's so easy to fall in. It's a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing that's happening to Ukraine and the Ukrainians. The massive devastation, the death, the injuries, the destruction of infrastructure, of people, of housing is terrible to see. Terrible to see. But just because we're sympathetic to the people who are undergoing this, and we might not like Putin. Just because that does not also make it true that the United States could not have done very clear and direct steps to have prevented this war from happening, and NATO itself. And there's people, and I tend to agree with them, who see this as part of this long legacy of domination, that NATO was not a defensive alliance. It was an offensive. It was against the Soviet Union and its allies. It was part of the Cold War apparatus. That's what it was about. So anyway, looks like we got one caller. I want to open up the phone lines here. That's already 20 of 9. I hope you found what I said interesting. 503-231-8187. Let's see who's on the line. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Harry, and thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk about this heat wave that's hitting Portland this week. And I was watching the afternoon or evening news, the local news, and they were talking about they had the city of Portland and a few other places had acquired quite a few air conditioners, and they were giving them away to senior citizens and senior citizens and low-income people. But the issue that they're having now is having enough people to install them. These are the window ones. So I assume during the wintertime they have to take them down. So, and also there was a Sandy Senior Citizen Center in here in Portland was giving away fans. So they were giving. I was just shocked to hear that they had. Tens of thousands of air conditioners that they're giving away, and the reason why was they mentioned was last year during the last heat wave last summer, we lost 70 people died because of the heat, and I assume this is pandemic money. I'm not too sure where they got the money from, but 70 people died last year, so I don't know how many people will be dying this year. And there was another article I read that in Arizona, since the beginning of this year, over 500 people have died of heat illnesses or heat, because of the heat. A lot of it is homeless. But it doesn't register that the homeless people are really suffering on the streets. And they opened some cooling centers and a few things like that for the ones on the street, but I was just shocked to see that 70 people died last year here in Portland.
Indeed, at least 70. Yes, and this is as the author of that article said, this is just the beginning. This is just the beginning. These are going to get worse and worse and worse, and every individual death is terrible. Every individual impact of these things. The problem is the cumulative impact is barreling down on us at such a rapid speed. And we do need to mitigate the effects by, I guess Carmen Rubio was on the news. She's the one who's responsible, the commissioner for this. And who knows what sort of obstacles were there, they should have gotten all out by now, but they haven't. But anyway, hopefully they're getting on it, and of course it wasn't in time for this summer. Hopefully we won't have another one of these. If we start having more than one of these heat waves in a summer, I don't know where we're going to end up. But yeah. Anyway,
this heat dome that we're having, I mean, they've had them before, but they never knew what to call them. So now that we can actually track these heat domes, where they're going, because of technology, we can tell what the weather is doing, instantaneously. So because of satellites and everything else, so we're keeping a good eye on this, but it's like... what else can we do? I mean, we have to cut down fossil fuels. I mean, what's doing this? And
right. That's why I keep saying we need to think much more strategically. We've been in a daze. We're all in a daze. You know, we're all in a daze because the system is so powerful and so harmful and so destabilizing of societies, communities, individuals. This capitalist system, it's so devastating that we're all in a daze, basically. And it's hard to get any, its propaganda machine is so vast. Its ability to deploy capital and shut down any efforts to oppose it is vast. And so it's a wonder that, you know, people are able to rise up anywhere at all, and I applaud everybody. But we're still, you know, since the fall of the Soviet Union, since the fall of the big, you know, revolutionary ideologies. Well, they haven't fallen; they're still around. But as a practical, you know, as world changing philosophies, they've lost their impact, and nothing has risen up to take their place, and that is of the same power of, you know, the Marxist inspired revolutions of the past. So we're all kind of in our like separate bubbles. We're all in these different ideological camps, and we're getting nowhere. So that's why I propose at least one common focus is to look at this problem of global militarism. It seems as utopian and quixotic as any other, but it seems like the only thing that has, to me, the only thing that really could actually address the problem, if we were to demand and start by, you know, some countries and some movements, you know, getting on board to get some kind of global framework to demand our nation states rein in these global militaries, which are the driving force of what's happening. Anyway, that's what I'll keep saying over and over again. I don't know. What do you think here? We got another caller coming up.
Okay, well, you answered me pretty well. And hey, thank you very much. And we'll go to the next caller.
All right. And looks like we got Mark on deck. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Paul. I agree entirely with your perspective that we need to develop an anti-fascist, an anti-military perspective. It's so sad that in the recent past, our country has canceled agreements, arms control agreements, like the ABM and the START agreement, as though we are just captive to the donor class and to the military. You know, militarism is never a solution, and wars always have two losers. Is there a reflection on Vietnam, on Iraq, Afghanistan? These are tremendous horrors and miscalculations. I wanted to did you see pictures on another, this is another subject, but did you see pictures yesterday of the floods in St. Louis?
It's not another subject, it's the same subject. These are all manifestations,
right,
of a climate system spinning out of control, wobbling,
yes,
out of control. No, I haven't seen the pictures, but the descriptions were bad enough. I think, well, not 9 inches of rain, I mean, geez.
And so people in cars were half underwater. The interstate highway was flooded. And then, of course, you know, our journalism is so bizarre. There were photographs. There was a reporting, and then suddenly it was just simply deleted. So it's very hard to find information. I recommend a new book that was published in Germany titled Degrowth and Strategies by Matthias Schweitzer. I think it'll be translated soon. And I think this is an important perspective. one that rejects completely the prophet motive and the prophet worship, which has really paralyzed economic discussion. I mean, companies say that if we don't maximize our profits, we go under, we disappear. The truth is that profit making is very different from profit maximizing, and that profit can never be the only criteria.
Indeed.
So our problems are endogenous. They're not exogenous. They're caused by our own system, and we are facing that implosion and the collective cowardice of the elites, of the powerful. I uploaded an article titled "Journalism Must Control the Powerful." So I put it on indiebay.org and laindiemedia.org. So I really recommend that.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you. I did find that article. Thank you, Mark. Always stimulating to hear. The whole degrowth perspective movement is kind of comes out of the a critique of capitalism. I haven't read deeply into it, but it basically says that a continually expanding production system on a planet of ultimately kind of closed ecosystems and finite resources is just an impossibility. So and it's but its logic continues to dominate. So I did find this article by Patrick Mazza. It's the second one. This is the second in a series of articles looking at this new book, speaking of books, The End of the Mega Machine, A Brief History of a Failing Civilization by Fabian Scheidler, S-C-H-E-I-D-L-E-R, Fabian Scheidler. And this article is called, it just came out a couple days ago on Counterpunch, Creating the Capitalocene. You know, there's the Anthropocene, the geologic epoch that is characterized by human influences on geophysical systems. And he calls it the Capitalocene, Endless Accumulation. I think this is well worth checking out. It's, I've said over the years on the show that one thing that we could use is some sort of common framework for understanding the world we live in. And we really need to get it really fast, folks. And we need to, maybe challenge our assumptions and challenge ourselves to get out of our comfort zone and realize that we do have a worldview, we do have an ideology, and it may not be the one most appropriate to what actually is going on in the world. So, just saying. Okay, so I just want to give you a flavor of this. The world system we know today was born in a time roughly from the mid-14th to the mid-17th centuries. We understand them as a time when the world came out of the, quote, Dark Ages into the Renaissance, when the light was breaking through. In truth, writes Fabian Scheidler, it was a time of unprecedented violence in Europe, of wars across the landscape, culminating in the genocide of the indigenous of the Americas. Quote, why does the early modern period come across as the new era of progress in humanism? The reason for cultivating this myth is obvious. It is crucial to the West's narrative of being the bearer of progress throughout the history of humankind. But what if our present system was actually built on a nightmare, born of naked violence and sheer despair? What if civilization did not make progress, but systematized barbarism instead? That's a quote from this book, The End of the Mega Machine, A Brief History of a Failing Civilization. And Patrick continues, and it looks like we got another caller, but it is that system which threatens to plunge the world into final nightmares as we confront the consequences of warfare and ecological destruction. Quote, we must thoroughly question the foundations of our economy, our state, and much more, Scheidler writes in his recent work. Again, The End of the Mega Machine, A Brief History of Failing Civilization. The system, or the mega machine, as Scheidler calls it, consolidated with the restoration of coin taxation, which under Rome and empires preceding it allowed the formation of standing armies. Again, that's my point about the development of militaries, about being key to the development of this whole thing. mercenaries would provide kings the power to put down peasant revolts. Funded by Italian bankers, mercenary armies roamed Europe, consolidating it as a war economy during the Hundred Years' War, which actually lasted from 1337 to 1453. And he continues. It looks like we got a caller. Robbie, go ahead. Hello. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hey, I really love the conversation. It's very refreshing to hear that finally people are seeing the Ukraine war as being just another proxy war against the two powers of America and Russia. But I kind of wanted to press people, like, I kind of wanted to challenge people's beliefs a little bit more, because, you know, back in, you know, February and March, when Russia and Ukraine were going at it, you know, there was a lot of support for Ukraine. And I think that speaks volumes to just the amount of propaganda and indoctrination people are exposed to. But I kind of wanted to bring up, there are protests going on in Europe right now, massive protests, and there is not much media. All there are is social media posts, and it started in Switzerland. There's Netherlands, France. They are actually protesting the World Economic Forum, which I think that this is a topic that many people on the left are not paying attention to. They dismiss it as it's some type of, I don't know, something not that they want on their radar. And ultimately, I am concerned about the World Economic Forum and what they're doing. But right now, these massive protests are actually challenging those globalist elite bankers. And they are trying to, they're kind of having their own. And it's really funny how political it is here, but the, what was that trucker convoy that was here? That was all those truckers. Mm-hmm. Basically, in Europe right now, they are doing all the farmers, all the people, they are blockading. They're trying to stop it because of the sanctions that are happening on the farmers there. They're trying to control the food, because I think people are able to see that we're going to have this, I don't know, food shortage. It's going to get pretty bad. And I think people see that coming on down the line. And what's going on now is, like in Canada, they're doing stuff that's suppressing the farmers there. And we can go into like the debate about whether or not fertilizer is good or bad. But ultimately what's happening is we are shifting to mega agriculture, which if you, I know you are very well aware of, is not beneficial to the planet or the ecosystem, that form of massive farming agriculture. And so it's just very interesting, because I feel like in Europe right now, they are highly against Bill Gates, who is not a doctor. They are against Charles Claus, that guy. I don't know if I'm saying his name right, but so, he's a part of the World Economic Forum.
So there's large demonstrations. Yeah, this is, you know, that's something that went on, you know, decades ago. Started with both the World Economic Forum and the WTO. You know, this goes way, way back. So this isn't anything
particular. Well, yeah, but it's happening now.
Okay.
France,
yeah, great.
And in Switzerland. I'm just trying to say, it's like, why is it that we don't have the same type of stance against the World Economic Forum that they do in France?
Well, I mean, that's
like
a long
calling it out.
There's a long history. Like I say, there's a long history to that whole movement, the so-called anti-globalization, or you know, a global justice movement that arose in the, you know, in the 80s, 90s, and built up to the, you know, the occupation of Seattle. And, you know, it's had kind of...
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah,
I recall
had
its,
that. That
was really good.
Had its day, sort of, and it's hard to, you know, it's hard to bring it back. But we're about out of time, right?
But you're talking about a globalist. You're talking about how are we going to get these governments to listen to this catastrophe happening. And it's like, well, I think that unless we're calling it out by name, they're going to get away with it. And it is a new name. It's the World Economic Forum.
They've been around for several decades. But anyway, thanks for calling in. Always good to hear you. I just wanted to just read another little bit from this. I think this is really incredibly useful, this end of the mega machine for trying to get us on the same page, for actually understanding how this historically this developed. I mean, there are a lot of things out there. This is a particularly good one. Anyway, the invention of the cannon around 1450 drove the economic requirements of warfare much higher. States were driven to accumulate capital to compete. That flipped the emphasis from earlier empires such as Rome and China, the central goal of which was to consolidate state power. In Europe, instead, the system became driven by the rationale of endless capital accumulation. The need for capital to build war machines drove wars to repay debt in an endless circle. Folks, that's the same circle we're caught in today. Anyway, so I can't recommend more highly this series of articles, again, by Patrick Mazza, who has his own blog, The Raven. Came out in Counterpunch the last week. There's two of them, and he's going to be continuing this. That's all I've got time for. I'll continue this subject until something changes. Paul Rowland here. Thanks for Ty on the board. Bye, everybody.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.